want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest in-depth interviews from peterbcollins.com. We're supported by listeners like Eric Prahl, Mark Brodsky, Aldous Tyler, and Stephen King. Thanks for your support. If you'd like to subscribe and you haven't already, get the details on the homepage right under my picture at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment of today's in-depth interview podcast, we'll be joined by Nadia Kayali. She is a legal fellow at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. We're going to talk about the local law enforcement use of surveillance drones. It's a controversy right here in the Bay Area. But first,
the story is true. Dragnet.
Dragnet Milano. 2003, February, the CIA scooped up Abu Omar off the streets of Milan. And you can substitute Bob Lady for Joe Friday in this little sequence. This was a case of what's called extraordinary rendition. The United States targeted an individual, found him in Milan, Italy, tracked him, picked him up on the streets, and flew him to his home nation of Egypt, where he had been imprisoned in the past, and Abu Omar reported that he was tortured in that round of custody following the American torture taxi flight. The definitive book on this is A Kidnapping in Milan, subtitled The CIA on Trial. Author Steve Hendricks returns to our program today. Steve, great to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
It was 10 years ago this month that these events took place in Milan. And your book remains, I think, just a brilliant account of this episode of massive bungling by the CIA that was ultimately exposed and led to the conviction in absentia of 26 total Americans. And last week, we learned of the sentencing to hefty prison terms of two high-ranking Italian intelligence officials. Niccolo Polari got 10 years, and his former deputy in charge of the northern Italian region, Marco Mancini, got 9 years. And to date, the Americans have remained protected by our government and have not been forced to be renditioned back to Italy to serve their sentences. This has been quite a story, and you really were on top of it almost from the beginning. Well, what are your thoughts as we look back 10 years?
It's hard to believe it's been that long, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, my thoughts are, above all, the continuity of within the American government from the highest levels. The Obama administration, as so many of us know, has been as bad as or worse than the Bush administration, which was just hard to fathom, on most matters of foreign policy related to the war on terror. He has maintained the complete protection of the CIA for its crimes against humanity. I don't use that term lightly. Torture, as defined in the UN Conventions Against Torture, are a crime against humanity. This is you know, not quite the level of killing millions of people in a genocide or something, but it ranks in the same class. It's not a misdemeanor. It's not a felony. It's a crime against humanity. And it's something that there was some mild hope that, you know, that the Obama administration would do something differently on. Maybe would prosecute a few of the, you know, people who authorized the torture, things along those lines. I didn't really expect in this specific case that they were going to cough up these essentially lower-level people in the CIA who carried out this particular rendition. But there was some hope that the Obama administration would do something, you make some gestures, do something along those lines. But in fact, they have maintained the Bush silence and cover-up and obfuscation of what went on. And I would have to say that, you know, over 10 years, the surprise is how little change there has been.
Well, and to be shown up by the Italians, frankly, and I'm not trying to smear anyone who loves Italy or who has Italian blood, but I don't think of the law enforcement agencies in Italy as pristine. There is corruption at every level, whether it's trying to get a telephone installed or, buying your way out of a speeding ticket from the Carabinieri. And so to see Italy's justice system mete out these substantial sentences, albeit 10 years later, is a remarkable contrast to what is, whether it's active or passive, obstruction of justice of a very intentional nature by the United States government and the Obama administration.
Absolutely. And you know, that was the CIA view as well. You know, they were aware of that Keystone Cops / corruption aspect of the Italian police and much of the judiciary. And for the longest, and so they regarded Italy somewhat as the laughing stock of Europe. And for many years, ever since World War II, the governments of Italy have typically functioned as, you know, this is a bit of exaggeration, but not too much, but as client states for the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA would tell them what to do, and they would do it. And if they wouldn't do it, then the CIA did things on their own. So, for example, the CIA and NATO actually set up, you know, secret, underground, embedded people in Italy who were ready to form a secret army should the Communist Party, which is legal in Italy, rise to power there. And I mean legally, if they were elected by power and they were still constrained by the Constitution of Italy. I'm not talking about a military takeover. They actually had caches of weapons and so on, you know, stashed all over Italy, and these people who they had taken off for training to other countries, you know, putting them back in Italy and in place. That's just one example of how the CIA viewed and dealt with Italy. Now, what they didn't count on was that magistrates, which is to say prosecutors in Italy, are appointed for life, just as our, say, federal judges are. Our federal prosecutors, who might, if they were independent, have, for example, brought charges against some of the people who authorized torture in the U.S., would never do that, have never done that, because they serve at the whim of the president and the Justice Department. But in Italy, there are independent magistrates, and particularly in northern Italy, and particularly within northern Italy, in Milan, who have a long reputation for independence, for courage, for fighting terrorists of the left in the 1970s, and for fighting terrorists of the right in other eras, and for fighting the mob all the way throughout. So, you know, there happened to be one of these courageous prosecutors named Armando Spataro,
mm-hmm.
who, when this happened on his watch in Milan, said, well, kidnapping is a crime. I don't care who commits it, whether it's the CIA or, you know, the thug down the block, and we're going to prosecute. You know, you suspect that had the CIA carried out this rendition in Naples or Sicily, we might never have heard about it. These convictions would never have happened. but the CIA didn't bank on, and quite possibly, as incredible as this might seem, might not quite have understood the degree to which that these people were not only independent but courageous and willing to take the stand and make the point that few other officials anywhere in the world had made or done.
Steve, one of the head-scratchers for me about these lengthy sentences for top spooks in Italy, Polari and Mancini, is that they were double-crossed by the CIA. They were monitoring the activities and tapping the phones of Abu Omar and his colleagues who were linked to a mosque in Milan. And Abu Omar was not an altar boy, not a guy with a totally clean record. And he appeared to be raising money for jihadist groups. He had some connections to people who were connected to the blind sheikh held responsible for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And so I don't, try to minimize that he appeared to be a target of some value to U.S. intelligence at this time. This is 2003. But the CIA, again, pulled a fast one on the Italian counterparts because they were conducting this opportunity in some sort of a joint manner. But then the U.S. pounced without notifying the Italians. So why is Polari and his deputy Mancini, why are they going to do hard time when basically they were hoodwinked by our guys?
Yeah, you make several good points, and let me comment on one of them first of all. Absolutely right. Abu Omar was not the proverbial choir boy. He was at a minimum a wannabe terrorist. He was involved with other wannabe or in fact terrorists, and my own belief is that he was a true terrorist, but low level. And the Italians, as you say, had him under very good surveillance. They were just about to, within the next week or month or, probably not week, but let's say month or months, were going to round him up and all his people. They weren't causing any trouble at that point. They had him under good enough surveillance to know if they were about to make a move. And in fact, after the CIA snatched Abu Omar, the Italian police did pick up all of his colleagues in his cell and convicted them all, which is what would have happened to Abu Omar. The CIA just wanted a feather in its cap. He was an easy target, and that's why they did it. Now, as to why these people were being, Polari and Mancini were being prosecuted, and eventually now, finally, after several years of prosecution and appeals to prison, is because there are many multiple and often overlapping police forces in Italy. This was a relic of the time of Mussolini when he didn't trust anyone. And Italians still don't trust, anyone in their country, to be a little hyperbolic. So in fact, what happened was the CIA was working with SISMI, the military intelligence group in Italy. They're sort of a combination of the CIA and FBI in that they have power to spy abroad, but also power to spy at home. And they are, Polari was the head in Rome, who the head of the CIA in Rome, Jeff Castelli, went to and basically said, you mind if we kidnap Abu Omar? And Polari said, no, we don't mind at all. We'll help out, in fact. Well, he was not the one who... His agency was not the one that had Abu Omar under surveillance in Milan. That was a completely different police agency. And the SISMI folks, with Polari and Mancini, did not tell the people in Milan that they were going to carry out this kidnapping, the cops from this rival agency, who were the main ones responsible for the kind of terrorism that Abu Omar was involved in. So they were the ones in Milan were the ones double-crossed. They had been working hand in glove with the CIA, both in Abu Omar's case and in many other cases. And when the CIA snatched Abu Omar, they were the ones who were completely hacked off. That valuable relationship was ruptured for quite a period of time. I think it's probably now mostly healed over. They're probably working together again, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But so those folks were double-crossed, and the ones who helped the CIA double-cross them were Polari and Mancini and a couple of others in Rome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating and a little complicated, I have to say. I spent some time reviewing your book again last night to refresh some of the details, and I do recommend your book. Is it out in soft cover yet, Steve?
It is not.
Yeah.
And one of the...
E-book? You got an e-book?
I believe they have put it on e-book.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that I learned when I published this book, which came out several years after the fact, 2010 it was,
mm-hmm.
Because these details didn't all come to light until about 2006 or thereabouts, was how little interest there was in the mainstream media in things like my book. So, you know, while it didn't do horribly in the bookstore cash registers, it was definitely not a huge hit. And my publisher, said, great book, nice try, but people aren't interested in hearing about torture and rendition so much, so odds are no paperback.
That's a real drag. I mean, if you'd just gotten Kim Kardashian to do a blurb for you,
Next book.
but you know, all kidding aside, it's tragic to me that a book like yours, which is extremely well written and well researched, but also about a very important bungled job by our CIA. I think it's very important for people to know about this. And before we started recording, Steve, I asked you if you had seen Catherine Bigelow's new film, Zero Dark Thirty, about the hunt for bin Laden. And you've taken a principled stand and decided not to feed her box office receipts, and I do respect that. But I sucked it up for you and others and went to see it. And it's deplorable in a number of ways because it's an infomercial for torture and leaves the very strong impression that torture delivered the information about the courier that ultimately led to the Abbottabad location and the raid in 2011. But the other piece of it is that it buffs up the image of the CIA. And while it doesn't try to make it appear that they're perfect and that they always figure everything out the first time and the right way, it's selectively marked with these little replays of episodes that are used to drive your emotion, the viewer's emotion, into saying, yeah, the CIA are the good guys and we got to go get the bad guys. And, there are no references to the bungled cases like Khalid al-Masri, like the Abu Omar abduction in Milan, and countless others. We now know from the Open Society report that 54 nations participated or supported rendition in some manner, like the way the Italians did here. Others permitted us simply to overfly their airspace. Some provided prison facilities, and some gave us the upgrade of outsourcing torture for us. But the outlines of these programs and the people responsible for them are largely unknown to Americans. And as we're about to confirm John Brennan to return to the CIA after a four-year stint operating the drone program and other counterintelligence operations from the White House, it really is sad, tragic, and frightening to me that so little attention is paid to Brennan's involvement in these operations. And while we have this 6,000-page Senate Intelligence Committee report that you and I aren't allowed to see, at least not yet, we know that it at least leaves the conclusion that torture didn't work. There appear to be some questions about rendition, but we don't really know the details. And all of these are unexplored. And in my view, when the Senate confirms John Brennan, it essentially is affirming that it supports all of these programs, even those that failed so obviously.
Yeah, as if further support for that were needed, as if that needed to be made more clear. I mean, the Senate and House, for that matter, have been just bending over backwards in every way to support both of our recent presidents in this sort of work. You're absolutely right. You know, it was what I was talking about before, about that hope that Obama might do something, just something, to signal that, that these sorts of operations were not okay. But in fact, you know, on the same day that he came into office and banned torture by U.S. personnel, he reserved the right, and his CIA director, Leon Panetta, reaffirmed later to reporters that they reserved this right to send people off, to capture people in these extraordinary renditions and send them off to places to torture. So America still has a policy of we like torture. It does not have a policy of, it has a policy that we just won't do it ourselves. We won't get our hands dirty, but we're happy to have other hands dirtied. When you don't go back and take at least a little chink at the John Brennans of the world, at the guys who wrote the torture memos, at Dick Cheney, George Bush, whoever, at some higher level, when you don't do that, you're absolutely right. You pay the consequence all down the line. And the Brennan confirmation, as I'm sure it will go through, as you're sure it will go through, is just one more, one more piece of that. And sadly, it is a piece that I think affects us more deeply. The you asked me at the beginning, what have we noticed over these 10 years? One of the things is the normalization, the routinization, the acceptance of torture. And the acceptance of many of our other deeds done in the dark, the drone programs that have killed hundreds, maybe thousands of civilians, all those sorts of things that we could probably speak about for hours. We accept them now.
And Steve, the real continuity here is the acceptance that when our government says that somebody is a really bad guy, that nobody asks for proof. Nobody demands evidence. Nobody says, well, what was the process by which you reached that conclusion? And while rendition and torture are deeply offensive and highly illegal, it is actually worse to simply take someone's life so that you don't have to capture them and you don't have to put them on a Learjet and transport them someplace and then interrogate them and then deal with some process of disposition. And, of course, we have over 50 people at Guantanamo for whom there will be no disposition. They have been told that they're going to be there forever without trial or charge. And this memo that came out of the old John U. J. Bybee office, the Office of Legal Counsel, most recently populated by Lisa Monaco and Marty Letterman, although their signatures are not on the memo that was leaked, the white paper. But, what we see Obama doing is expanding the definition of imminent threat in the way that John Yoo and his boss George Bush expanded the definition of torture so that they could claim that they're operating within the law and that everything's okay. You don't need to look more closely at these cases.
Absolutely. And, we, meaning the American people, go along with it. It's part of that routinization I talked about, normalization. To me, one of the saddest moments of the last campaign was late in the campaign when the Obama administration leaked some details about its drone program and its kill lists. Lists of people that, as you were saying, he reserves the right to do whatever he wants with. People anywhere in the world, anyone anywhere in the world, including American citizens, but to me that's the least of it, he reserves the right to kill. That people didn't rebel against that, that there wasn't some outcry, but B, that they knew, the White House, that was the case, and that's why that stuff was leaked. You don't leak something late in a campaign like that, if you think it's going to hurt you. You know quite well what you're doing. There were high-level sources who, from the White House, who leaked them. They leaked it because they knew it would be popular. That kind of thing is popular, that we are happy to have an American president who is supposedly protecting us from all the demons in the world, and we don't question, there's no oversight, no judicial check, nothing. Even if you agreed with some in some principle that we needed a targeted kill program, to have no check on it whatsoever, on the ultimate presidential power to kill somebody, that's horrifying.
Well, and the most aggressive questioner in the Senate intelligence hearing in John Brennan's confirmation process is Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon. And I applaud that he raised some important issues, but they were about process, not about policy. It was about, well, when are you going to give us the memos, and why aren't you sharing the rationale, and why won't you disclose this? But he didn't raise any questions about the underlying programs, and even if people are comfortable with the lack of process and simply a minor trial in the media of Anwar al-Awlaki, who's been linked to the Fort Hood shootings as someone who offered inspiration to a crazy guy, to Hassan. He's been described as involved in the Abdulmutallab attempted underwear bombing of the Northwest airliner as it was landing in Detroit. Again, was he operationally involved? Did he help strap that explosive device on the kid? We don't have any information to support that. But even if you accept the public information about Awlaki, his 16-year-old son had run away from home to find his dad. He was not a jihadist. He was not militarized, or as we try to call it, a militant male in any definition of that term. And again, using the language of the white paper, he did not pose even the most ridiculous interpretation of the term imminent threat. And no questions were asked of John Brennan about why this 16-year-old kid born in Colorado was executed by a drone strike. And there's no outrage. Most, according to the polls, most people just say, oh, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, and it's a sign of how little opposition there is, of course, and how Wyden and the few others like him in the Congress know it. That all you got in that confirmation hearing were questions along the lines of what you're talking about. You know, it is when there is so little protest and outrage, it is hard to figure out what the heck to do. On the other hand, the fact that those of us who are outraged, or many of those of us on our side who are outraged about it, that so many folks keep quiet about these sorts of things, obviously, doesn't help us, does it now?
Well, and I want to widen the definition of what you just said about our side, because everybody knows my politics. I'm a left of center. I'm left of Barack Obama. But I continue to call for those who are so gravely concerned about their Second Amendment rights to look at the other aspects of the Bill of Rights, at the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment. And if the gun lovers were as worked up about the Fourth and Fifth Amendments as they are about the Second, I might find more common ground with them.
It's a fine point. There's certainly enough hypocrisy to go around on every side about this. But, you know, the general level of jingoism and false patriotism that exists both on the left and the right these days really does make it impossible to have a decent discussion about this. Any discussion along the lines of what you and I are having in most other venues would be called unpatriotic.
Yeah.
And that few people are willing to stand up to that.
Steve,
are
you aware of the case of the British, he's now no longer a citizen, but he's a 23-year-old British resident, whose name is Mahdi Hashi, and he is now being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York. He was reverse renditioned there from Djibouti, where he had been a tourist last summer. He was held there, subjected to what we would consider light forms of torture, but they intimidated him by exposing him to others who were being more seriously tortured. And he's accused of terrorism and is not at Guantanamo, but he is at a federal lockup in New York City. And the only coverage I have seen is from the London newspaper, the Daily Mail.
I have heard just a very little bit about him. And the thing that will be curious for me is, since he wasn't sent to Guantanamo, since he was sent to New York, does this harbinger trial? Does this mean he is actually going to get some due process and get an attorney and either be, you know, fairly convicted or fairly acquitted? And if he is, that would be one tiny but significant step in the right direction.
Well, and we had all the hysteria that prevented what Eric Holder, the attorney general, attempted, which was to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged accomplices in federal court in Manhattan. And we were told that the earth would stop and that all kinds of evil things would happen. And now the Congress has tied the president's hands with legislation in the defense funding bill that prevents anyone being brought from Guantanamo to the United States for almost any reason. And even those 86 men who are cleared for release and stuck there now in the abyss of Guantanamo, the process for them to be certified by the defense secretary for release even to third nations willing to accept them is so cumbersome that I have referred to Guantanamo now as a tomb for many of these individuals.
It really is. You know, you're right, the president's hands are now tied about what he can do about bringing them to the States or elsewhere. You know, I still have never understood why we can't bring a trial to them. You know, there would obviously be, you know, it's not like you're going to import 12 of our peers or their peers to Guantanamo, but you could hold a bench trial by a judge down there with, you know, you'd probably have to pass a few new regulations to get that done. But, you know, why aren't we doing at least that? Why aren't we making any effort? My sense is that the Obama administration is perfectly happy to have its hands tied.
Well, you may be correct about that. Steve, I wanted to ask you to briefly describe for people the events of February 2003 in Milan, and in particular, the incredible violation of the fundamentals of covert operations by many of the 26 Americans who've now been convicted in absentia. Because I think that it's worth reminding people how badly bungled this operation was, and that there are probably many others like it that we just don't know about.
Quite probably. You know, if it didn't happen, if it hadn't have happened in a country like Italy, a first world country, we probably wouldn't be hearing about it. You know, yes, you're absolutely right. Our CIA officers were Keystone Commandos over there, and they were because they thought they could get away with it. So, you know, from the very beginning, the rendition seems to have been the brainchild, at least in part, perhaps in the whole, of Jeff Castelli, who was the CIA chief in Rome at the time. He was a man on the rise, and there were people all over the world, his peers, CIA chiefs of station all over the world who were doing renditions. And from the best of what we can tell, he wanted a feather in his cap. As we'd said earlier in the program here, Abu Omar was not a threat. He was about to be arrested. Not a problem with him. But Castelli wanted a rendition. It would look good on the resume and help you rise to the top if you pulled one off. So he authorized it, got the cooperation of the Italian intelligence, as we said, and then, you know, it then passed on to the chief in the CIA chief of the office in Milan, Bob Leidy. And Leidy, for whatever reason, probably arrogance, probably because he had a close, great working relationship with the various police agencies in Milan, decided not to take what were really fairly minimal precautions. So, for example, rather than use satellite phones to communicate with the nearly couple dozen agents who were there on the ground in Milan scouting out Abu Omar and eventually kidnapping him and so on, rather than use satellite phones to communicate with each other, which would be untraceable by the Italians, they used cell phones. And the cell phones, every time it's on, it's constantly making connections with cell towers. And while the Milan prosecutor could not go back after the kidnapping, after the fact, and reconstruct, you know, get actual conversations off the cell phones, he could get the records from the cell phone companies of everywhere that all these people were moving around. So he was able to, you know, once he determined that the kidnap had happened in a certain place and time, which, by the way, was practically high noon on a street in Milan, only a block off one of the busiest streets in Milan, and the way that he figured out that there was a, you know, not just that Abu Omar had disappeared or gone to ground as a terrorist or whatever, but that he was disappeared, kidnapped by the CIA, was that there was a witness who had just sort of happened onto the scene. So for, you know, the very place that he was kidnapped was a sign of arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
But so then Spataro, this prosecutor, was able to go back and track all these people's movements who were around the place at the time and where they were afterwards and so on, and then, you know, trace the movements of the van that they had used to kidnap him in by the toll cards that they had bought carelessly and paid for in ways that were traceable. They had, when they went to hotels, had used passports, some of which were fake, a couple of which seemed to have been the real names and identities of people, but at any rate contained enough real data on them that someone like me, who is a reporter, but I don't specialize in the CIA, I don't specialize in renditions or Italy or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
I was able to track down the whereabouts of about half of these two dozen people in the United States.
And if we can just single out for special notice, Monica Adler, because I had bookmarked this particular page in your book. She arrived in Milan January 9, 2003, three nights at the Westin Palace, then to the Principe di Savoia, room 704, which you describe as the pinnacle of Milanese hostelry. Then she slips out of town and goes to the Hotel del Golfo. Then she overnights in Florence and the Grand Hotel Baglioni, then at the Hilton in Milan. And you say that at just one hotel, she ran up a tab of $8,000.
Yeah.
And you also described how she and some of her counterparts made sure that they got mileage credit or you know, hotel gold card credit, whatever those things are called, reward programs, for their stays. And this, you know, they of course wanted credited to their real names so they could use it on their next vacation. But this created a very clear paper trail that was available to you, and that's, you know, without a warrant or subpoenas, you were able to discover a lot of this information.
Absolutely. And, you know, half the hotels that you list there were little vacations that they took. You know, they were scouting this guy, some of them, for as long as a couple of months. You know, maybe even, I guess, 3 months, the very earliest ones that we know who came over from the U.S. as part of this operations team to do the snatch. And so, yeah, they were living high. They would take little trips to the beach. They would take trips to Florence. They were not staying in the cheapest hotels. And that was, you know, a sort of funny. You know, there were people who were less outraged by the torture of Abu Omar than they were that the American taxpayer was, you know, funding these boondoggles.
Mm-hmm.
That the CIA folks were having. But it was, you know, to me, that was just a symptom. You know, it was a symptom that all of this was great fun for them. They didn't have to worry about, you know, what Italy was going to do. They could treat this almost as a vacation, and they did. And, yes, you were absolutely right about the frequent flyer miles, you know, rental car miles, those sorts of things. And again, you know, they thought that they could do all of this because the Italians were our allies, had always done what we told them to do, and this would continue forever, I suppose.
It's quite a story of American arrogance and blunders and the way we look forward and not backward. Steve, thanks for joining me again today. And just for our listeners' benefit, you're on your way to Milan tomorrow, but not as a follow-up on this big story.
Indeed. I'd spent 4 years working on this book about CIA kidnapping and torture. 4 years before that, I wrote a book about how the FBI had royally screwed American Indians during the 1970s, my next book is about soccer in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So I am going to Milan to watch AC Milan and FC Barcelona head off in a Champions League clash. I'll see some old friends and revisit some old haunts related to my CIA book. But, I needed a break.
Well, maybe you can, shack up at the Westin and charge it to the agency.
I've got their frequent flyer numbers. For that matter, I've got their credit card numbers. What an idea, Peter.
Steve, you've got a website, yournameplus.org, and Hendrix is H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S. stevehendrix.org, if people want to follow your work. And an e-book is available, do you think, at Amazon?
It is.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, that's the best I can suggest, unless you can find a hardcover edition still available. It's really a great read, and as you can tell, I appreciate the detailed work that you did on this, and I'm happy to give it another spin here and hope some new listeners will pick up on the story and also pick up your book.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Steve Hendrix here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Next on the Peter B. Collins Show, we take a look at the local law enforcement use of unmanned aerial vehicles. Drones over Brooklyn. Our transition music of the moment here is called Drones Over Brooklyn by LP. And today we're going to start off by talking about drones over Oakland and the county in which Oakland is situated, Alameda County, here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Nadia Kayali joins us, and she is an attorney, a legal fellow at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And you've heard us talk with Shahid Buttar, their executive director, on many occasions in the past. Nadia, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you have been supporting activists who have been speaking up about the local deployment of unmanned aerial vehicles. And here in the San Francisco Bay Area, the county of Alameda is grappling with the issue, as the sheriff, Greg Ahern, has asked for authority to buy and deploy a 4.5-pound video drone. This is, we want to stress, an unarmed aerial vehicle, at least as it's currently configured. And he even brought a prototype to a meeting that you attended last week on Valentine's Day. Tell us a little bit about the sheriff's characterization of this new gizmo and why he thinks he needs it in Alameda County.
Sure. So you actually made an interesting use of language there. I heard you say both unmanned aerial vehicle and drone.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to stress that the sheriff has been very insistent about using the phrase unmanned aerial vehicle as opposed to drone, even though I think most of us would agree what we're talking about people would think of as a drone. And part of that is for the reason that the sheriff is characterizing what he's going to use this for. Now, I think when most people say drone, they're connecting it to military technology that can be used, of course, in targeted killings, but also in surveillance. The sheriff has repeatedly stated that he would want to use the drone in particular for emergency situations as well as search and rescue, hazardous spills, things like that. However, right before the meeting, the sheriff issued a draft policy which had 10 different uses for the drone. And these uses included post-crime evidence preservation, as well as incidents where there would be probable cause to find evidence of a crime being committed. So the policy that the sheriff submitted to the Board of Supervisors as well as to civil rights advocates actually had a wide range of uses. And very little control on that wide range.
Mm-hmm.
So although the sheriff has said, again, he's repeatedly said search and rescue, it's clear that he would want to use this for surveillance, for spying, which really practically, you mentioned the drone was 4.4 pounds. That's exactly what this drone is best at doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not particularly well suited for the kind of uses that he really stressed it's much more well-suited for the kinds of uses that he sort of quietly included in the policy.
Now, did the sheriff make a case that they're already using aerial assets in the form of fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters, and therefore, you know, this is not a slippery slope, it's not an incursion into rights, it's just a new, cheaper, unmanned, low-risk way to conduct the same activities that they already have been doing without any real pushback from civil libertarians?
Well, the sheriff actually spoke very little about the other kinds of aerial technology that they have available. The only point that he made is that the drone would do some of the work of a helicopter, but more cheaply, as you mentioned. However, what he didn't mention and what civil rights advocates who were at the meeting did mention is that a drone is in no way a one-to-one trade-off for a helicopter. Helicopters are much more audible, so surveillance from a helicopter is much more noticeable than a drone.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, helicopters can be flown at night, and they can be flown in bad weather, whereas drones can only be flown during the day. They can't be flown during bad weather, so if there's high winds, if there's heavy rain, currently the technology for drones doesn't allow them to be flown in that sort of weather. The drone that the sheriff wants to purchase can only fly for 12 to 25 minutes. And again, it has to be in line of sight of the operator. So again, that sort of technology really is best suited for surveillance, not for search and rescue or the other kind of things that, in addition to surveillance, helicopters do conduct surveillance, but they also are used for search and rescue and these other means. And that is really not what drones are good at.
Well, I don't want to get too wonky on the technology here, but I am a little surprised to learn that the flight time is only a maximum of 25 minutes, because what we're told of the military drones that are used, these big Raptor and Reaper and Predator drones that are armed aerial vehicles, is that they have very long flight times and can go great distances, operate from very high altitudes. So this is much more of a Radio Shack version, isn't it?
I'm not certain if you've seen the pictures, but there is a world of difference between these drones and the Predator drones. But interestingly, you know, the drones, at least one of the versions of drones that's used for targeted killings now actually did start out as a surveillance drone. It wasn't a surveillance drone that was available to the police, but that is how it started out. So these do come from the same base of technology in terms of how they're controlled, and the way that they sort of orient themselves. But there definitely are differences.
Well, Nadia, just at the outset here, I want to note that I consider it very healthy that activists and advocates are not only concerned about this, but are speaking out. And when you compare the activism at the local level with the lack of interest and the passivity of our national elected leaders who have permitted the expansion of the use of militarized drones that actually kill people, with very little debate, no congressional oversight, and much more we're seeing in the hearings related to the confirmation of John Brennan as CIA director, that even the liberal advocates like Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, they're not attacking the underlying policies. They want to be informed. They feel that they have been left out of the loop, and they certainly deserve to be consulted and be able to conduct their oversight responsibilities, which I feel they failed miserably at. But there is, I think, a real contrast between the concerns that are being expressed at the local level and the way our national leaders have simply allowed the Obama administration to expand the use of this technology without any real debate or limitations on how it's used, and also preventing it from falling into the hands of adversaries and enemies.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that you really touched on sort of what Bill of Rights Defense Committee's theory of change is, which is that you are constantly seeing that at the local level and even at the state level, these sort of issues that seem big, they seem like something that nothing can be done about, people are taking action. And, you know, it's interesting, you mentioned sort of the liberal advocates on these issues. One of the things that we've seen is that there's currently actually legislation on drones pending in 13 states. And out of those 13 pieces of legislation, 9 of them are sponsored by Republicans. So this is definitely a bipartisan issue. Privacy is a bipartisan issue. Concern for the use of these technologies domestically is a bipartisan issue. And, you know, I think it's a lot more likely that we are going to be seeing these issues addressed at the local and the state level. Although I do want to put in a plug for Ron Wyden that he, in terms of issues of surveillance and privacy, he's actually been one of the most vocal voices. And I think his sort of baseline is that you really can't address these things if you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other issues as well that he's really pushed on. And in his position, he has access to information that he can't always share. And it's interesting. You know, there are a lot of there's a lot of ways in which even advocates at the federal level are sort of stymied in their efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much he really can do, but I know that he's definitely tried. Unlike, unfortunately, a lot of other officials we've seen, including, I think, those from California.
Yeah. No, Ron Wyden is the best we have in terms of advocating for our interests in terms of the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments and the incursions that we've seen on those elements of the Bill of Rights. But he disappoints me because rather than really oppose the Brennan nomination based on the actual policies and the use of these remote-controlled vehicles, he really came up short, I felt, in the confirmation hearings and seemed content to demand more information and more sharing of information with the Intelligence Committee, but not really challenging the president's policies. I also wanted to ask you what you do or don't know about the reports we heard that they had deployed drones in the manhunt for Chris Dorner, the former Los Angeles Police Department member who got fired and then reportedly went on a murderous rampage that ended in the burning of a cabin in at Big Bear in San Bernardino County. And it appeared that at some point in that manhunt that federal authorities were called in and that some of these assets may have been deployed. What do you know?
You know, at this point, I think there's been some controversy about that. I was definitely sort of following that. There was a lot of social media coverage of that. There's a lot of tweeting. But it's actually unclear whether there was a drone used. There was some article suggesting that there had been. There was some suggesting that was a hoax. It's really unclear. As far as I know, the latest is that there was not a drone used. Although, interestingly, there are now advocates in the drone industry, which figure very strongly, by the way, in these attempted purchases of drones that we're seeing across the country, saying that an unmanned aircraft may have saved lives, but their argument for why is not particularly strong.
Mm-hmm.
Their argument is, and I'm quoting, had a drone been able to be used in that environment, who knows what could have happened? Well, exactly. Who knows? I don't think anybody knows.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is important to note that drones are a spawn of the California military-industrial complex. Some are made in Simi Valley, some in San Diego, and virtually every big defense contractor now is some way connected to the UAV developments, and there is a UAV caucus now in the Congress promoting their interests. So coming back to the controversy in Alameda County, what do you think were some of the important points that were discussed in this meeting between Sheriff Ahern and members of the Board of Supervisors?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the most important points that was discussed is that the policy that the sheriff has provided is vastly overbroad. It allows for a lot of use that is outside of what he's arguing he wants to purchase the drone for. Similarly, the sheriff really didn't address the concerns brought up both by the community and by the advocates that were there, which included ACLU, Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as Alameda County Against Drones. The sheriff really didn't address the concerns about the technology, both that limits the current use of drones and would allow for the use of drones to become more problematic in the future. So there was very little response to these concerns. You know, as I mentioned before, drones are extremely limited. They have to be flown in sight of the operator, this very short flight time, 25 minutes maximum, only during the daytime, only during good weather. They have sensitive equipment. They can't necessarily get that close to a fire. So the sheriff didn't address any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't address the fact that drones are really best used for protests. You know, or they're best used for surveillance. That's really what they're good at. And, you know, I think a lot of people, particularly in from the community that came, civil liberties advocates, particularly Linda Lai from the ACLU, made a lot of really good points about the policy, about the loopholes in the policy. And folks from the community, again, they were really stressing a lot of the people in the community were very active, you know, go to protests, and I mean, Sheriff Ahern's comments about that. I mean, at the end of the meeting, he actually stated, "I wouldn't be using it for that sort of thing." But before the meeting, to a number of press that were gathered around asking him if he would, you know, would you use a drone in a protest? Would you use it to surveil that kind of activity? If not, why don't you put that in your written statement? His exact words were, well, we don't want to rule out a lot of uses. So.
Well, and Nadia, for our listeners outside the Bay Area, I want to make a clear distinction here. The Alameda County Sheriff's Department is different from the Oakland Police Department. And I refer to the Oakland Police Department as a rogue agency. For more than 10 years, it has been under the surveillance of a federal court. It has been ordered to make significant changes in practices, and one of the most critical is that officers are required to report wrongdoing by their fellow officers. And in the Occupy protests that occurred a year and a half ago, that clearly did not take place. And while, again, these are different agencies, there is a mutual aid agreement between the city of Oakland and the county of Alameda. And if given this this drone, the county sheriff could deploy it in street protests in Oakland or other activities that Occupy and you and I may not have even contemplated at this point, whether it's, you know, the way they shut down the port or other protest and legal peaceful demonstration tactics that were used, but that also provoked outrageous and illegal responses from uniformed police officers who were on duty to manage these protests. And so I think that we have to look at this and the connectivity here, and that in particular the Oakland Police Department cannot be trusted to take into account the best interests of the citizens that it is obliged to protect.
Absolutely, and you know, you made a really good point about the sheriff and the Oakland Police Department and their relationship. I mean, one of the current lawsuits that is stemming from the Occupy Oakland protests actually names the Alameda County Sheriff mm-hmm. as a defendant, and that lawsuit has the potential to cost the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, in addition to the city of Oakland, thousands or maybe even millions of dollars. You know, and this is the kind of liability that we argue that the sheriff is opening himself up to in a different sense as well. You know, it's not something new. It's something that we've seen before. And, you know, one of the really interesting things the sheriff said at the meeting is that there is a potential to deploy this drone all the way from Alameda County north to the Oregon border. And that has to do with the fact that the Alameda County Sheriff's Department is a coordinator for a region, I believe that it's a emergency management region, but mm-hmm. potentially, you know, this drone could have consequences far outside of Alameda County.
Well, it's interesting that you raise that, because one of the other points that I wanted to make, Nadia, is that just last week, where I live in Marin County, which is north of San Francisco, and this is a bedroom community. The largest city is San Rafael, which is about 70,000, something like that. So we're not an urban area. And yet our county sheriff just got approval to purchase a $370,000 armored vehicle. It's like a Bradley fighting machine, and it is designed for response to a weapon of mass destruction. Now, this is such a far-fetched scenario. It's like the one that we're led to believe that Iran could launch a missile at Western Europe, and therefore the United States has to deploy a missile defense system for reasons that still aren't clear to me. But all of this seems to be driven by the Department of Homeland Security, that dangles money before these local law enforcement agencies. And they don't pay for all of these purchases, but they pay for enough of it that it's seen as a good deal. And then the argument is used that, well, Marin County is a regional responder, and this armored WMD vehicle will be available to our neighboring counties. Now, none of our neighboring counties has a nuclear power plant, any nuclear facilities. I'm not aware of any biohazards that other than the refinery, the Chevron refinery in Richmond, that could pose a risk if terrorists took control of such a facility. So these are really far-fetched scenarios that we are being fed as we're seeing the militarization of local law enforcement agencies funded by federal tax dollars coming through DHS.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's something that this idea that local law enforcement should just be able to go outside any sort of democratic process, outside of the process that is set for them getting funding and having their funding approved by elected officials, they can go directly to the federal government, they can get these grants, and they can purchase things that otherwise, you know, it's pretty certain wouldn't have been approved. And you know, it sounds like Marin County has already gotten this armored vehicle. I don't know if you heard, but there was actually a very similar issue in the city of Berkeley last year, where the city of Berkeley wanted to get an armored vehicle, and fortunately activists heard about it beforehand. They fought the purchase, they won, and now actually the city of Berkeley has a policy where any of these grant applications that are going to be going forward actually have to go in front of city council.
Mm-hmm.
But it's shocking to know that the city had to actually create a resolution. They had to vote in a policy to make that the policy, that until then these grant applications got no review. And I would encourage activists anywhere to really push for these kinds of policies, you know, to push for review of these grant applications by local elected officials before law enforcement can use the money or can, you know, even apply for the money. Who knows what exactly they can purchase.
And Nadia, this raises important issues, again, that aren't usually very thoroughly explored by people. In California, the structure of government is that the county sheriff is directly elected by the people, but he or she has to get approval on budgets and expenditures from the county board of supervisors. And so who gets to make a call about, A, the purchase of this kind of equipment, particularly if the bulk of it comes from federal funds, and B, what the rules of engagement are for the use of these gizmos? And often we see elected officials just deferring to the elected law enforcement official, and either they're complicit in supporting and remaining silent, or sometimes they're afraid to take on a powerful sheriff. Ahern has only been in Alameda County for a few years, but Charles Plummer, his predecessor, served over 30 years. And these people build up a power base, and it makes it difficult for the supervisors, who are often short-termers. They might serve two or four terms, something like that, but they don't sit there for a lifetime like often a sheriff does. And so these are in some ways unexplored turf in terms of who gets to make the decisions.
Absolutely. You know, this is really an area of the law, local government law, and in particular, Board of Supervisors authority over sheriffs, that is unsettled. There are some good decisions, and, you know, it's really up to elected officials to push on their authority and take their authority as far as the people who elected them want them to do. You know, I Alameda County is a great example. It's clear. I mean, the hearing on Valentine's Day, it went for 3 hours. There was over 100 people there. A lot of those people were testifying. There was a petition that was signed by hundreds of people from Alameda County. You know, it's clear where people. And there was, and I should mention, there was only one person at that hearing that had anything positive to say in the audience that had anything positive to say about drones.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty clear where the people of Alameda County want their elected officials to go. And the question is, will those elected officials do that, or will they be, as you said, I think you made a really great point, that there is a certain amount of hesitance. Sheriffs are seen as, you know, they get elected, and they do have time to build a base for themselves. But I think it's time to question that. You know, sheriffs are not just running jails. They're not just covering, you know, small unincorporated areas. They are elected officials that have a lot of power that has not necessarily been granted to them by the fact that they got voted in, mm-hmm. particularly when they run unelected, which yeah. happens quite a bit.
Yeah. Nadia, anything else you want to add about drones? I want to shift to another topic that you've been working on.
Only that I would encourage anybody who's concerned about this issue, not only in Alameda County, but anywhere that might be listening to this, to get involved. You can actually check out our website, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, which is just bordc.org,
mm-hmm.
To get involved. You can certainly contact us. It's just organizing@bordc.org if you want to get involved in Alameda County or anywhere else. We have campaigns on this issue and a number of other issues going on around the country.
And I will insert a link in the show file related to this podcast at peterbcollins.com to make it easier for you to connect with BORDC. Now, one of the other issues that you've been active on that I care a lot about is the detention policies that are embedded in Section 1021B of the 2012 defense budget bill called the NDAA. And we have covered this extensively here at the Peter B. Collins Show. Carl Mayer, the lead attorney in the case brought by Chris Hedges, Dan Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, and others, has been on our program as recently as 10 days ago following the most recent appeal hearing in the federal case. And it has drawn uneven attention, Nadia. Certainly, people who listen to this program are quite familiar with it, but the general public appears to have little clue about these draconian policies and the unconstitutional aspects, and very clearly drew a permanent injunction from Judge Catherine Forrest, an Obama-appointed federal judge, in a blistering decision that was issued on December 12th of 2012. And we saw a kind of muddled effort in the Senate to clarify the language of the 2012 NDAA in the 2013 NDAA, but ultimately a badly written amendment from Senator Feinstein was dropped in the conference committee. And so, to be clear to people, the 2013 NDAA is essentially silent on the aspects of the 2012 bill, which remain in full effect, and which the Obama Justice Department has gone to great lengths to keep alive. And so what it permits is that on the allegation of some relationship to terrorism, and it uses murky language like material support, an individual up to and including an American citizen residing in this country could be detained without charge or trial indefinitely and possibly at a military base under the language of this bill. It is a serious violation of our Fifth Amendment rights to due process. And a very conservative senator like Dianne Feinstein appears to have recognized that. So at this point, there doesn't seem to be a legislative solution at the federal level, and we're going to have to see how it plays out and if it does ultimately go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But recently in San Francisco, we've seen the introduction of a resolution by the chair of the Board of Supervisors, the president, David Hsu. Tell us what this measure attempts to do, please.
Sure. So this resolution, which was introduced last week, sets a policy for San Francisco. Well, it starts off by emphasizing that San Francisco values civil liberties. It mentions a lot of the concerns with the 2012 NDAA, which was reauthorized without change by the 2013 NDAA. A lot of those concerns about Fifth, Sixth, Eighth Amendment rights. And then it sets a policy for San Francisco that we're going to uphold those rights. It asks our local agencies, our public agencies, not to comply with indefinite detention. And then it also asks the mayor to send the resolution to our elected officials. So it does a number of things in addition, of course, to setting San Francisco policy. It actually really makes the opposition to this law clear. As you mentioned, the debate at the federal level has been stagnant. We've seen not as much coverage of something as concerning as the potential for indefinite military detention on U.S. soil as you would expect. And so resolutions like this, and I should mention San Francisco would actually be the 18th city or locality to pass such a measure. We would also be the largest. And many of these have actually been passed in quite conservative areas. So, again, just like with drones, you know, we're really making it clear that this is a bipartisan issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it would really amplify the voice of people in San Francisco who are opposed to indefinite military detention by having the resolution sent to federal officials.
And, Nadia, it doesn't have any real binding impact, right, because federal law preempts these local ordinances that would address the negative impacts of the federal law but can't actually change it, right?
Well, of course, the law is going to remain what it is at the federal level, but to the extent that it may be local law enforcement that would be carrying out the indefinite military detention provisions of that law or maybe assisting in carrying it out, this resolution sets a policy that San Francisco is not going to participate in that. And I think it's important to mention that this is a very real issue. You know, this law was introduced today, actually, is February 19th. Today is the anniversary of the signing of Executive Order 9066. And for those who don't know, that order allowed for the internment, of 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is something that is very real. And one of the most famous victims of this was Fred Korematsu, who actually did not comply with the order. And he was actually arrested by police in San Leandro, and he was held in San Francisco County Jail. So it's certainly something that we've seen before, that local law enforcement has participated in this kind of thing.
Well, and you raise a good point there, because the use of local police authorities by federal law enforcement teams is seriously problematic. And the Joint Terrorism Task Force, JTTF, these are creatures that have been created in the last 10 years. And it's very murky. There's not much transparency. And so when the FBI, for example, uses the draconian elements of the Patriot Act to go through my trash or my phone records or my bank records, and they often do coordinate with local law enforcement agencies. And so the extent to which we can put the brakes on that and require at least a level of disclosure and adherence to locally generated policies by local authorities, well, it will at least put some limits on the federal government's ability to run roughshod over local sensibilities.
Definitely, and I think that, you know, in a place like the Bay Area, where we do have some pretty strong local laws, you mentioned the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and I think that's a great example. That's another thing that's been going on at the local level that there has been some fights around. But San Francisco has some very strong standards when it comes to intelligence gathering and surveillance, and having local law enforcement just signed up to work with the FBI without supervision is really problematic when you have local standards that are much stronger than the federal standards. So, you know, it's constantly something that activists can be working on, really pushing on local policies and not letting our local law enforcement, which we pay for, and which really should be under our authority, carrying out these federal policies.
So the status of this resolution is it was introduced by the president of the board, David Hsu. It's drawn co-sponsors from Supervisors Avalos, Breed, Campos, Kim, and Marr. So it appears to be just one vote shy of passage. Is that fair?
Yeah, you know, we're feeling pretty positive about it. You know, it's looking really strong, having all those co-sponsors. And I think you mentioned, Marr, Avalos, Campos, Kim, Breed, and then so it actually has 6 votes out of the 11-member Board of Supervisors. So, unless something momentous happens, you know, we really feel pretty positive that it's going to pass. And the vote is actually happening just next week on Tuesday at the meeting.
Well, then I want to encourage our Bay Area listeners to get in touch with those supervisors, make sure that they don't change their minds, and let the other ones know, the more conservative, at least for San Francisco, supervisors know that you care about this issue and you would like them to support it. And then any read on Mayor Ed Lee? He was one time a community activist on legal issues, but he's pretty hard to read on some of these.
Yeah, you know, and I cannot honestly tell you. I don't have a strong read. I feel like this is not a particularly thorny issue, so I'm feeling positive that he will sign on. You know, if he doesn't, we'll certainly continue pushing on him. We won't drop it there. We'll discuss the resolution with him. But I think I'm feeling pretty positive about it, particularly with the kind of support that it has received. You know, we've seen a really broad base of support. There have been people from the Japanese American community supporting it, people from the peace and justice, the faith communities, labor, the Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian community. There's really a wide range of support. And I would absolutely encourage anybody who supports this resolution, please do email, particularly any supervisor that you're a constituent of, and let them know that you support it and you want to see a yes vote from them.
Great. Well, Nadia, we've talked about drones and the NDAA. Give me a short list of the other issues that you're active on here in California right now.
Well, you mentioned the Joint Terrorism Task Force, so Bill of Rights Defense Committee is actually working with a group that is trying to ensure that in San Francisco there's a full and adequate report from Chief Greg Suhr on his activities with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. There was a law passed last year, the Safe San Francisco Civil Rights Ordinance, that requires a report of his activities. And in addition to that, the group is also working on community education for the Arab, Muslim, Middle Eastern, and South Asian community, but also with other communities that can be affected by these problematic federal policies like surveillance. So that's one piece that we're working on. In addition, as I'm sure you know, there's a lot going on in the state around secure communities and local law enforcement helping Immigration and Customs Enforcement do their job. That's another piece that we're working on. We're really hoping to see that policy, particularly at the county level, get better. There are also a number of other places that are working on NDAA resolutions, including Los Angeles. We're working on that. We're hoping to see that a resolution passed there. This is potentially something that could go to the state level also. NDAA, there could be a law at the state level. Also, you know, there's a possibility for legislation at the state level on drones. And then finally, the last piece that we're working on in California is the coalition that I mentioned earlier that discovered the armored vehicle request that the Berkeley Police Department had made. Mm-hmm. They're continuing to do their work of monitoring the laws that they got passed, as well as working on concerns around racial profiling in Berkeley and beyond.
Great. Well, Nadia, thanks for joining me today, and I fully support the work you're doing, and I hope you will not let up.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nadia Kaoli with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. She's a legal fellow. Visit their website at bordc.org. Thanks for joining me for this latest podcast. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.